Brian Lehrer on WNYC, little schedule correction. Nina Totenberg coming up in a half hour from now after the news at the top of the hour. Right now, an issue that we're suddenly aware of because of Occupy Wall Street. We know that it's within our rights to assemble in public parks, but is it within our rights to sleep in public parks? And is it within our rights to occupy a public park and set up camp for the foreseeable future? And what happens if those public parks are actually owned by private companies? The answer to each, it's complicated. There are over 500 privately owned public spaces in New York City. I'll bet you didn't know that. And they exist because the city offered subsidies and zoning changes in exchange for the private development of new open space. That's how Zuccotti Park was created in the first place. But since it's public space owned and maintained by a private company, in this case, Brookfield Office Properties, the rules are a little different. Like, they can be open 24 hours a day, and so the protesters can actually live there, unlike regular public parks, which close. So our question is, when public space is owned by private companies, how public is that public space? And we actually want you to help us answer that question. So we have partnered with a brand new website, a news organization called the New York World, on a new project where we're asking you to visit these privately owned public spaces around the city, publicly owned private spaces, or POPs for short, and tell us what you find. Joining me now to explain exactly what we're looking for is Yolaine Almanzar, a reporter for the New York World. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having
me. Also joining us to explain why these POPs exist and why the rules are different from regular public parks is Harvard professor of urban planning and design, Gerald Kaden. He literally wrote the book on this. It's called Privately Owned Public Space, The New York City Experience. Professor Kaden, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
Yolaine, where and what are privately owned public spaces, and how did Zuccotti Park become one of these?
Well, I first found out about these spaces about 4 weeks ago, just when the Occupy Wall Street movement was starting up. And just like you mentioned, there's this special law that sort of allows developers to build bigger, taller buildings in the city, and in exchange, they provide these public spaces for the community. Since then, in my reporting on places on the East Side and in Midtown, I found that some of these spaces do work, but a lot of them often are either uninviting, inaccessible, or not very well maintained.
So tell our listeners what we're asking them to do.
So what we're asking you guys to do is to go to thenewyorkworld.com, all spelled out, and there's a map there where you can find all of these 500-plus spaces in the city. Each space has a special, unique ID assigned to it, so find the letter and number attached to it, and then tell us what you see. Tell us about your experience there. From then, we'd like to gather this information and sort of figure out what can be done to enhance these spaces and make sure that they stay public.
We want to know, are they actually accessible to the public? Are people using them, and for what? Are they clean and safe? And folks, you can see the map online right now. Just go to our webpage, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and the instructions are right there for how to participate. You can choose to report on any of the sites and fill out a simple form about what you found there. You can even tweet us photos, which we will compile, of these various privately owned public spaces in New York. And Professor Kaden, it's because of you that we have this data. You worked with the Municipal Arts Society years ago to compile data on these more than 500 privately owned public spaces. So give us a little background. Tell us why and how these POPs were created and what developers got in return.
Sure. Well, to begin with, let me add the third and crucial collaborator, which was the New York City Department of City Planning, because at the planning department resides all of the information and an enormous amount of expertise on these spaces.
Great.
So in 1961, the idea of privately owned public space was actually made concrete in the zoning resolution. That zoning resolution introduced the idea of trading to office and residential developers 10 square feet of extra floor area in their building above and beyond what the zoning would otherwise allow if in return they provided 1 square foot of plaza at the base of their building. And the same trade was introduced for something called an arcade, except it was 3 square feet of bonus floor area for every square foot of arcade. The definition back in 1961 was, to say the least, undemanding. If a developer provided a space that would be accessible to the public at all times, then the developer received the floor area bonus. There were no requirements about seating and landscaping and other types of design and functional amenities that would humanize the space or truly make it usable by the public. But they did have to be open to the public at all times, and developers jumped all over this, obviously demonstrating the financial deal that was very favorable to developers. They did nothing wrong. They followed the letter of the law, but they provided a lot of spaces that were unfortunately not of high quality, not really even of usable quality. So you wander around the city now and you'll see a lot of these odd places. They have nothing in them, but indeed they are privately owned public spaces, and the developer's building is probably larger because of them.
Yolaine, do you have an example of that by any chance? Kind of useless but public space that a developer got something in exchange for?
Well, there are just recently on Saturday, an organization that advocates for privately owned public spaces, Friends of Privately Owned Public Spaces, did sort of a mini tour of these arcades in Midtown. And a lot of these arcades are exactly what you say. Some are being used as cocktail lounges. Others, when you walk through, there are no seats there. Or they rush people along. These are some of examples of buildings that kind of got ahead in the deal but aren't holding up their end.
So, Professor Caden, people probably never heard of Zuccotti Park, for the most part, until Occupy Wall Street. Was that a privately owned public space success story even before this?
I think it's a space in the middle. It's certainly an effort by the developer to make it a better space than arguably would have been required, and over the years they have indeed improved it. I think it's fair to say, and it's important to be fair, that there are good spaces and there are bad spaces. Unfortunately, there were a lot of bad spaces, but it's important to recognize there are a lot of good spaces. And Zuccotti Park, by providing seating and landscaping and public art quality lighting, has made an effort over the years to make that a good space. And after all, it was named after the co-chair of their company, and I can't imagine that he would want to have attached his name to a space that at least he couldn't walk by when he went to the office and say, this is a nice sort of place.
Good point. Do you happen to know what they got in exchange for creating the public space?
I do, and it's interesting. Unlike virtually all of the other privately owned public spaces in the city, the owners, actually it was the developers back in 1968, did not receive a floor area bonus. They did, however, receive other valuable zoning concessions. In particular, the tower that they constructed immediately to the north of Zuccotti Park is allowed to legally violate certain rules regarding the shape of their building. So they could do something that they otherwise wouldn't have been allowed to do. And in return, they had to provide this space. So it was an incentive zoning transaction, a deal. They got something and the public got something.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we are unveiling our newest WNYC crowdsourcing project and map. Go to our webpage, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and you will see a map of all of the 503 privately owned public spaces in New York City, like Zuccotti Park, where the Occupy Wall Street protesters have set up camp. Almost all of them are in Manhattan. A few of them are in Brooklyn. You'll see that they concentrate in Lower Manhattan around the Wall Street area, also in East Midtown and the Upper East Side, and then there are some in some other places. And what we're inviting you to do is pick one of these places from our map, visit one of them, and tell us how public they are. Are they actually accessible to the public? Are people using them, and for what? Are they clean and safe? The map is online right now, so you can help us report this story, taking stock of all 503 privately owned public spaces in New York City. Now that people are more aware of them because of Zuccotti Park, and tell us how effectively or honestly, they seem to be being administered. And with us for the introductory conversation for this project are Gerald Kaden, a Harvard professor of urban planning who wrote the book, Privately Owned Public Space, The New York City Experience, and Yolene Almanzar, a reporter for The New York World, which we're partnering with on this. And I want to play a clip of the Real Estate Board of New York president, Steven Spinelli, represents developers. And he's talking about the rights of the owners of the privately owned public spaces. They are camping out 24/7, obviously, in Zuccotti Park, and he wants that to change.
I do believe that plazas should have the right to shut down at a certain time because they were not meant for camping out.
So, Professor Kaden, first of all, why is the rule actually more liberal than in a public park? They can kick you out of Central Park at, I think it's 1 a.m. because it officially closes, but they can't kick you out of a privately owned public space, which has to be open 24 hours a day. Is that accurate?
Well, it's partially accurate. It's really a matter of happenstance. The city owns its parks, and it introduced a rule in general that closes its parks at night. It's the owner. It can do that. Zuccotti Park happens to be created under a special permit and a zoning provision that, at least as of now, has not allowed them to close the park. They are right now not authorized to close the park at night. And there are other privately owned public spaces in the city that are not allowed to close at night. However, there are also still other privately owned public spaces in the city that are allowed to close at night because they negotiated that from the get-go, or they subsequently applied for an authorization for nighttime closing, which is a provision in the zoning ordinance that would allow owners to do so, and they received it from the city. So it really depends space by space on what the rules are.
You have any sympathy, Yolene, for Brookfield Properties seeing this park being used not for what it was intended for, but as a kind of permanent encampment? You know, some people say, look, this is a pretty nice public space that's going to wind up getting destroyed, no matter how pure the intentions of the Occupy Wall Street individuals.
I mean, I think while it is a privately owned space, it's still, like you said, a public space, and it's up to the public to decide how they want to use this space. Now, up to now, Brookfield Properties has seemed to be cooperating with the movement, and I think that should kind of be the spirit going forward. Let's try to cooperate with each other to make sure that these spaces remain a space that the public can use in the way that they see fit.
So, Professor Kaden, what is the promise that the city makes about these privately owned public spaces? When people argue that it's our constitutional right to occupy a public park, are they right according to the law and beyond the law? Are they right according to your sense of right and wrong as a social contract?
Well, those are the two big questions. One is a legal question, really under the Constitution. And the Constitution does apply to publicly owned property and in general doesn't apply to private property. So indeed, the city government does have to respond to claims of free speech rights, et cetera. But they are allowed, nonetheless, in general, under the First Amendment, to apply rules that don't pick and choose between different political actors. So you're not saying, I like your message, I don't. So you can use my city-owned park, but you can't use my city-owned park. As long as the city applies what are called time, place, and manner rules, you know, sometimes, someplace, some manner, but not always, the rules generally survive constitutional scrutiny. Now, here we've got a private owner and this odd kind of thing, privately owned public space. Some people maintain that because it's a private owner, definitionally, the letter of the Constitution and the free speech clause doesn't apply because it only applies against government. Other people argue that Brookfield and the city together have really created something that's more like a publicly owned space. I tend to believe it's an uphill climb to make Brookfield subject to the Constitution. If I could just say, that doesn't mean, however, that they should be able to discriminate against political use of their space and prefer other kinds of uses. But the issue is, what are reasonable rules to apply in the space?
Robert in Manhattanville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Brian. Brian, you know, one thing that occurred to me, and you've touched upon it, but that the focus on Zuccotti Park and the whole notion of an encampment is in some respects a response to the Bloomberg administration's policy over its three terms to sort of suppress public dissent in an organized way. That is to say, public marches of a political nature, let's say near Wall Street or Broad Street, or parades of a political nature. And I hark back to the demonstrations against the Iraq War. I think that was the second or third year of Mayor Bloomberg's tenure, where there were mass arrests.
February 2003.
Right. And that, so to some extent, the administration, if it had been more receptive or encouraging to having these type of marks, including quote-unquote Occupy Wall Street, being permitted to have regular marches of a political nature, then the sort of the need to occupy a park or a public space, no matter how symbolic the occupation aspect is.
I understand. It's an interesting point that, Yelaine, maybe we'll just leave unremarked on unless you have anything to say.
I mean, it is interesting. I hadn't thought of it sort of that way. I mean, I think Zuccotti Park really has made this about Occupy Wall Street, and now we found out about these spaces. So I think our map is sort of trying to figure out how these spaces can be maintained once Occupy Wall Street or all these sort of, you know, things that they're concerned about maybe end in the future. How can we continue to follow up on these spaces and make sure that what we know, what the property owner's obligations are, and what the public's right is to these spaces.
Chris in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you? A question for Dr. Caden about a column that I assume he probably saw on Monday in the Wall Street Journal on his editorial page, and it described the whole process of creating these privately owned public spaces as, quote, crony capitalism. That's the journal's word. The subhead of the story was political extortion created Zuccotti Park, and it allowed protesters to remain despite the noise. And stink. You probably saw this. I wonder if Dr. Caden would say that that's a reasonable interpretation of these sorts of deals. And are they any different than the deals that you get throughout the country, where localities are always negotiating with developers, for concessions and proffers, as they call it, in order to offset the public impact of the development?
It's a good and correct question. And there, again, like anything else, there's no absolute answer. I don't view it as extortion at all, because this was truly incentive zoning. So as long as developers had a right to build a substantial building, which they did at the beginning, then this was over and above that right, and it was up to them. They could build the building without a plaza, and it could be very, very large, 30, 40 stories without the plaza, or they could build it with the plaza, and then it would go to 50 stories. So it would be something more. They weren't, in short, required to provide these spaces.
And there we have to leave it. A fascinating conversation, I think, and as an introduction to our latest crowdsourcing project. And again, we are inviting you to visit any of the 503 privately owned public spaces in New York City, like Zuccotti Park. We'll assume that Zuccotti Park is being sufficiently covered now, right, Yelaine?
I think it is.
And go to the map that we have on our page. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show, and you'll see the locations for all 503 of these privately owned public spaces. And we want you to go there, see if they're being well maintained, see if they're accessible for actual use, see if they're set up for actual use. Are people using them? And you'll see some other questions that you might ask as you be some of the eyes and ears for this public reporting project. So again, go see the map at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You have 3 weeks to visit a space and report on what you see, and we will come back on the air and wrap up the project at that time around November 9th. So we thank from Harvard University's Urban Planning and Design Department, Gerald Caden, who wrote Privately Owned Public Space, The New York City Experience. And we thank the New York World, a brand new news organization online that we're partnering with on this, and Yolaine Almanzar, reporter for the New York World, who's working on the project with us. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Nina Totenberg next.